Welcome, book lovers. We are back. Phil Spitek and Marissa Serafini and I are here talking about The Diamond in the Window by Jane Langton. Wow, what a fun book. We'll get all into it. Phil, your first thoughts of this book.
Yeah, I was excited to read it. It is not something I knew beforehand in terms of the author, in terms of the book. I do like books like this, right? Just in reading the summary and kind of things about it, it reminded me, let's say, a Wrinkle in Time or, you know, the Chronicles of Narnia. But then, of course, it's set in Massachusetts, which is great. A place I know pretty well in the history. So there was a lot of elements going into it. And overall, it's a fun book. I mean, it is a children's book. I enjoyed it enough, but it's one of those, like, it's good, but it could have been great for me. I think there's a lot to love, but it just could have, I feel like could have been elevated. So.
Oh, interesting. All right. We will definitely have a fun conversation. I thoroughly enjoyed this book. I first have to admit that I heard about this book via podcast, listening to someone else talking like feverishly about it. Like they were like really not spoiling a lot, but they were going into a chapter. I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. And then of course, like 2 hours later, I ended up buying the book. I was like, yeah, sure, why not? And then, so going into it, yeah, I agree. It gave me a very Wrinkled Time, Madeline Engel kind of, you know, children adventure kind of book, and, you know, which I'm always for. And I also did see, and I mean, Harry Potter came later than this book, but I did see maybe where a lot of, you know, like supernatural, quote unquote, magical elements could come from this particular one. So I really did enjoy it, and it's a lot headier than I thought it would be for a children's book. It goes into transcendentalism, where I'm sure kids at the age of 12 probably don't even know what that is. Granted, you know, a lot of adults don't even know what transcendentalism is. I had to go back and be like, oh yeah, that's what it is, you know. So we'll definitely get into it. First of all, for those who really don't know about transcendentalism, it's like this period of time and this belief, this philosophical belief that, like, and I have it not to, so I don't butcher the definition. It's the advocated idea of a personal knowledge of God, believing that there is no intermediary need for a special insight. And it can get like really, I don't want to get too confusing about it, but it's basically, you know, the idea of individualism, idealism, and the divinity of nature, that there's a knowledge out there that you don't just learn from what's been given to us. Like we can read or see something and then we can understand something even more beyond what we're seeing at face value. So it's kind of like the idea of something more than you're actually seeing on the page.
Yeah, I mean, it's this idea that we overcomplicate life, right? I mean, you know, Walden, the most famous book by Henry David Thoreau on it, certainly referenced very heavily throughout. But, you know, for a light and fun understanding of transcendentalism, ironically, Office Space is a trend. Like, if you really watch for it, it is a transcendentalist sort of philosophy ingrained in there, you know, of like just being like, why do we have to do, you know, one of the famous lines in like Walden was like, all these, you know, we built these pyramids to honor, you know, these pharaohs who are no better than anyone else, you know? And so like just this, yeah, deconstructing essentially like all the things within society that have meaning and like why, you know, when most of it, it's just advancement for the sake of advancement. And we're always in this hurry just to, you know, go, 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 when we don't stop and really examine things is really what it's about.
Right. And, you know, it's just the idea of, you know, free thinking and not always being, like conformist in that way. You're thinking beyond outside of the box of what everyone else is like conditioned to think. And, you know, that could be very And like it could be very hard to wrap your head around, especially for this book, which is labeled a children's book. So had I read this when I was younger, a lot of the idealism would probably be like over my head, not gonna lie.
But I think it's no different.
As an adult, you being as an adult, did you understand the messages that were taken away from this?
Yeah, I mean, I read a lot deeper into the subtext than, you know, if I was at that younger age. But I imagine that's no different than, you know, A Wrinkle in Time or even Chronicles of Narnia with its, you know, Christian undertones. You know what I mean? Like, it's one of those things, like, true art in that way, you can take it at surface value and just enjoy it for what it is of like, okay, here's a kid's adventure and that's great. Or you can also, you know, read it on a deeper level, and at the same, you know, no enjoyment is better than the other. It's just different experiences. So I think that's the strength of the book.
Right, absolutely. And so let's get into this book, shall we? Diamond in the Window. Not to go like word for word, you know, and completely recappy, but it does start with the two children. We have Eleanor and Edward. They're siblings, Eleanor being the oldest and Edward being just a few years younger, both redhead. But their house is basically on the brink of getting repossessed by the bank, and their aunt and uncle, their fun aunt, Aunt Lily, and their crazy Uncle Freddy are, you know, basically their prime guardians, and primary guardians. And they set off on this adventure. They find this attic-like room with two bedrooms, and they're like, oh, you know, kids used to be here, or like someone used to reside in this room. And it kind of like sets us off on the adventure. They find messages on a window, and it's kind of like a scavenger hunt treasure, and off to the races we go. So being, you know, children's book, and we've read a lot of adventures, how did you think the setup for what we were expecting for the rest of the book? Did you like the setup?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it has conflict right away, and you know, it sets off in that way. I mean, I think the only nitpick I would have is it felt like the longest time in terms of what they were allotted to like pay these back taxes for the house, you know,
yeah.
as opposed, you know, like it's not to say like the book itself was long, but you know, like the traditional thing would be like, you have 2 weeks to sort of pay this off for a month. And that's it. This seemed like we were given like half a year, maybe a year almost. And so in that sense, you know, I think the things could have still kept the same, but just the pressure of needing to complete this and the, you know, perhaps the worry of Aunt Lily and so forth and making this happen, it wasn't as evident, you know, to really drive it home.
Yeah, I do kind of agree with that. I thought, I was like, oh, wow, they're taking very, very long time to rustle up $700+, which, I mean, yeah, that's a lot of money up front. But over the course of 6 months, I was like, I think most families could probably figure out how to acquire that much money. So, like, I didn't really see that timetable jeopardy all that pressing, because I found more of the conflict of the book wasn't the repossession, it was them just trying to figure out every adventure that they went along and tried to acquire every jewel, ruby, doll, you know, all the adventures in between. Like, they were still trying to find answers, yet finding treasure that could have ended up being the hard cash that they needed to help save their house.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the adventures were great, but their entry point was just essentially falling asleep. And in that sense, the choice could have also been to not continue, right? Like, I know that it got more dangerous as they went along, but I think that's the difference for me with, like, a Narnia and Wrinkle in Time is once they were in, it was the point of no return, right? And I'm glad that they did keep going and so forth, because I mean, ultimately, I guess in that sense, it was a choice, simply because they needed the money, right? And so it worked in that way. Like, I really did enjoy. I thought the adventures were fun in that way, and inventive, and almost like Roald Dahl-esque, and just crazy, wacky, you know. And you just
characters
accept
in
it.
between.
Yeah, you just accept it for what it is, you know. Like, hey, a bubble flew by and ate him up. You're like, okay, that's meant to be literal. Got it.
Right. And or like another dream, like, oh, now we're mice getting chased by a large screech owl. So, and again, you know, going into that, you said the entry points were the dreams. Did you like that that was how they acquired, quote unquote, every treasure, that they had to get to a subconscious state to get into an adventure? Where I feel like a lot of books, you could go outside and kids could have their own imaginary adventures rather than being the subconscious type.
I mean, you know, even I guess it's that aspect that that relates to transcendentalism, of like going in deeper, right? And that sort of meditative state. But even for me, it's a level of understanding that I didn't really think too much about. I just kind of accepted it as like, okay, this is the means of which it operates.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
like, that's how it kind of like, again, probably one of the most recent contemporary reference I can make right now is Inception. You know, that they have to, you know, go into dreams to get the thing that they're, you know, looking for, they're searching or planting an idea. Like, they actually have to get to this certain state for them to succeed in whatever their mission was. And that was with these kids. I feel like it was every time they fell, almost quote unquote, every time they fell asleep, then I like, my thing was, I was more questioning like how they both ended up having the same connected dreams. Because we know two people can have similar dreams, but they never really explained how they both ended up being in the same dreams every single
I just
time.
I just took it as it was the room, right? They move into the attic, and that's when everything begins, right? And certainly once towards whatever, towards the end, when they went downstairs, they weren't having the dreams. Then of course Eddie sneaks off and is able to enter into it, and then Eleanor has to do the same thing, right? So I think it's just the nature of the location that was a key factor, and that's how I took it as.
Okay, so do you believe that the room really played a part? Because, yeah, now that I think about it, were they, when they had their dreams, were they in any other places? I was like, they had dreams in their regular bedroom, did they?
No.
I'm trying to remember.
I'm pretty sure now looking back on it, I think the star
bed.
The star of India, I think, was the key to it all.
Okay, you see, this is why we're talking about this book, because we both have different interpretations. That's interesting. I could think of like another movie without completely spoiling the subplot, but Hide and Seek. If you've ever seen that movie, Robert De Niro, basically, if he goes into a certain room, something happens to him, but he has to physically be in that location for him to mentally switch something that happens within the movie. So I think that could have been like something. So this room, this attic room, was the catalyst for them to have their adventures.
Yeah, it's like, to me, it was the attic itself was the closet for Narnia, right? You can't enter Narnia without the wardrobe.
The wardrobe.
And this, you can't enter without being in that room. I mean, to me, that's why, like, Aunt Lily, you know, that's why they never seen that room, because, you know, Aunt Lily was scarred by it, and then she allowed him to stay in there. And then once the bad, you know, he hit his head, she's like, all right, no more attic sleeping for you.
Right. I mean, and as we go along with this adventure, it gets more and more perilous. I mean, it started off with an injury, scrape to the leg, and then it's like, now they're getting chased by an owl. Now they're getting pummeled by a castle falling on them and having legit concussion and potentially serious brain damage. So yeah, it did get more and more dangerous, and I felt like that is the true nature of children's adventure. Like, the farther along you go, the more dangerous it gets. And so my light keeps going in and out. But I did like that, though, because with, you said, Aunt Lily, it seemed like she had, like, some idea of what the room did, but she herself had never gone into those adventures, but she knew it was, like, so closely tied to her brother and her best friend and Prince Krishna. So let's get into those characters a bit. So it's really Prince Krishna, scavenger hunt, really. And he ended up playing a bigger role than I thought. So
yes, what, no, what I mean, were your favorite characters? I mean, it was interesting because yeah. he started it, but then his uncle basically bastardized it, right? Because he entrapped everyone and then no one could get out because of the wicked uncle, which we learn very late in the book is like the twist to it all. But yeah, in that way, it felt like a Jumanji of like, the only way out is you got to finish the game.
Yeah. Agreed. That's true. And I did like how, you know, throughout the story, you see Aunt Lily's like slow revealing. We learn more about Krishna via Aunt Lily. That eventually they started off as like a young friendship that developed into a young love, and then fortunately he disappeared, and then now it just became a lifelong pining.
Yeah, because they never interact. I like that. Yeah, I mean, no, they see those characters, but they never have a conversation. If anything, Eleanor and Eddie are just kind of like trying to shout at Ned and Nora and the prince.
Yeah. So. And like, we really learned about Ned, Nora, and Krishna via Aunt Lily and via their dreams of what the small details of what Eleanor and Eddie only knew from their aunt. And then as they go into the dreams, then they physically see them in corporeal form and like what they look like, what the personalities are. So as readers, as we're reading along, we're getting a better understanding of these characters too, that they got caught up in the same adventure whirlwind and they got stuck there. Very Jumanji-like.
And then when the game
gotta
is over,
get them out.
The game's over. They're old as, you know, as if nothing had happened except, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, this Jane Langston, Lincoln, she's from the East Coast, and her writing,
very evident.
Yes, her writing is known to have a lot of transcendentalism influence. We had Mary Louise Alcott in this book, Louisa May Alcott. Wow, I completely butchered that. Louisa May Alcott's book. We had Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau. So what were your, did you like those external, I guess you can say, influences into this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was nice because I think they explained what they needed to make it work, right? And luckily I do know enough about each of them. And I thought it was just fun because like, what made it great was Uncle Freddy, right? And just, you know, sort of just the crazy uncle at that point, you know, who just lost his marbles type of thing.
Comic relief, definitely. Yeah,
you know, and so it brought in those characters and it gave him a voice for what was happening in a way that like, because it's a very contained story. I mean, there's not a lot of characters. So if you take out those, you basically just have the family and sure the banker and secretary, but they don't make a lot of entrances.
No, and they only appear like maybe 2-3 times in the book, and if that, only for like a paragraph. So they're just the characters that are ever looming, like they constantly remind you, it's like, oh hey, at any time we could take your bank, or you, we could take your house if you don't pay the bank back. So they're just like checkpoints throughout the book. They're like, hey, you still need the money. And kind of brings us back to reality in that sense. But Uncle Freddy, I kid you not, when I was reading this book, I was laughing a lot every single time we saw Uncle Freddy and the weird sayings he did, or him disapproving of the marriages of the bus, even though they were, having fun and, playing pretend. And then especially the moment when they're down at the beach area and he's basically harassing kids to the point where he actually gets arrested. And I'm just thinking, like, he probably shouldn't be allowed out in public near people.
Yeah, that was a bad choice,
You
and they realized.
gotta, right, you gotta keep a close eye and watch out for him. But every time I saw him, I was like, oh man, he is literally the example of what could go wrong had he got, out of this adventure, because he's the epitome of, like, hey, if you're not careful enough and you don't take care of yourself during these adventures, you could end up mentally unstable like him.
Yeah, but at the same, he was in his own sort of way, right? A very integral part in helping them figure out certain clues, right? Just the randomness of what he said all of a sudden clicked in a way of like, wait, I didn't realize that, right? For the kids. And so then they're like, all right, cool. Now when we fall asleep, think about this. And it allowed them those entry points that they wouldn't necessarily have figured out by themselves.
Yeah, like that missing clue that they needed to help move them along. So out of all the adventures and the ones in between, was there a certain adventure or message that, like, really stood out to you?
I'll take the adventure part. Once the what was it called? Like the place of the souls. It was towards the end. It was before the bubbles and things like that. I thought that because it's the most darkest, right?
Like the sea treasure one with the
It was like.
shell.
No, it was after that one. Let me the name of the chapter is
I read
yeah,
treasure.
lost or found. No. But yeah, I just liked, for me when it was really getting to that dark,
The chambered Nautilus.
could have been. I think it's the one after that. The palace for the soul. That's it.
Okay, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I thought that that was like my favorite chapter. Because here they're starting to realize the dark turns that their choices are putting them in, right? So it's really hitting home. And in that way, they're making the choice to really keep going, right? In spite of the fear, in spite of what may happen. So that's when it got really fun for me.
Okay, yeah, I definitely agree with that. But my favorite was the whole mirror adventure, because I feel like that was a nice precursor to the Palace of Souls, because that was our first foray into how important decisions are and how they impact our life and the paths that we go on. And this is where, these kids are young and they're in that turning point of pre-teenager, teenager, and that's like when people are first finding their identity, who they are. They're becoming self-conscious. And we see Eleanor, she's not liking her red-headed gingerness and freckles. So she's becoming very aware of her looks, and she wants to, borrow makeup from her aunt. And then this mirror world that they go into, it's like with every decision, she first started off with choices that were for vanity. Like, she wanted to look more prettier. And as she was going along, the decisions were getting more narrow. She didn't have choices, and she just ended up being on this decrepit route. And then, but the moment that she started accepting her physical appearances and who she was, opportunities kept presenting itself. They multiplied. So, and I loved the idea that these kids had some level of you know, freedom in their choices, but they also saw the immediate ramifications of what it could do to them as people. And that's a tough thing for kids to understand, but also it's important for them to learn.
Yeah. I mean, for me, that was a very like inspiring part of the story, certainly by the end of it, in the simple way that I think, at least for Eddie, he realizes that ultimately he can be whatever he wants to be, right? Because one of his goals is to be the president of the United States. And then he sees himself as that, but he also saw himself with the ability to be other things. So it's just a matter of making that choice and working towards it and knowing that, you know, he's capable of anything that he wants to be, right? And then, like you said, Eleanor accepting herself for who she is. So I think, yeah, that is one of the more powerful, upbeat sort of chapters, I think, especially for a kid.
Yeah, absolutely. And it set the parameters of what Palace of Souls was like. It, you know, it taught them like, oh, if you make this decision, it could end up having certain, you know, ramifications here. And going into Palace of Souls, like, oh, if you decide to do this, then this could happen. So I think it was, it's a great chapter, and it definitely fits in within the children's book, quote unquote, young adults, because that's what kids are going through at this age. You know, it's about learning who you are and your true self, and whether you like it or not, making the decisions to change yourself or making the decision to accept who you are and just, you know, go on your merry way in that sense. And I really liked it.
Very good chapter indeed.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So we get to, I mean, kind of cut to the Palace of Souls. This is where, like, the whole climax of this story and the adventures come to. They finally get to that point where, Eddie got stuck, first of all. And Eleanor, they break the diamond in the window, legitimately, like, literally, the title of the book. And that was actually the key component that helped get them past that point where the Ned, Nora, and Krishna actually got stuck, because they didn't have that. So this is like that we finally get past that point of no return, that it helps, you know, it really helps like push the story along and actually get some resolution.
Yeah, it's that classical sort of aspect of the object will present itself to one who is worthy.
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
This is what I'm saying with Harry Potter. Like, you have the Philosopher's Stone, the Sorcerer's Stone appearing when it needs you, or the Sword of Gryffindor appearing when the wizard needs it the most.
Sword and the Stone, right? Like, when you have, you know, the idea of that, whoever has, like, a pure heart will be able to pull out the sword, because it's not about strength, it's about just being the right person, right? Right. So there's any number of, you know, I mean, it's a tale as old as time in terms of genre convention, but yeah, it ended up being a very key component, and you know, their hearts in that sense were pure, right? So mm-hmm. You know, the diamond allowed itself, you know. Eleanor was the one who first called it forth, and then she willingly gave it to Eddie, and then, you know, Eddie willed it and kept it,
right? And it was given, it wasn't taken. And I that really, there was that difference where it's also, again, very Harry Potter, like, sorry, but like, this is the most current reference I could think of, like the whole Elder Wand, the true possessor of the Elder Wand has to earn it. It can't be forced and taken away. They have to like legitimately earn it. That, and then they can wield the power. And that was the same thing with Diamond. Like, they earned it. They didn't force it and take it away from anybody or steal it. They earned it on their own merit, I guess you can say.
Yeah.
And that was the whole difference between the evil Maharaja wanting to take it. He was like demanding it. And that was the weakness. That's why he couldn't overcome.
And it was, and you know, I mean, it was, yeah, it was a great realization for the kids to realize of like, hey, you know, we literally stood our ground. And I mean, they were just threats. Like he could not physically take it if we didn't give it to him, and we didn't succumb to, you know, the darkness.
Yes, absolutely. Now I have to ask a question, because quite honestly, when I was reading it, I was a little confused. So maybe you understood it better and comprehended it better than I did. But with that, in the adventure dream, they released Ned, Nora, and Prince Krishna. Gosh, I keep messing up the name. Krishna. And then in reality, when they wake up, the real adult versions of them were released because they were imprisoned by Prince Krishna's evil uncle. So did you think this was too easy of a resolution? One, did you think it was too easy of a resolution? And two, did it make sense?
I think it made sense. I think, you know, was it too easy? Perhaps, but I think when you're writing a kid's book, you tend to have a very upbeat, happy ending, right? And so in that sense, I'm not going to knock it. You know, if this was a more, if this was novel for adults, then it would have played a little bit differently perhaps. So I don't knock it for that. And as far as taking it literal, like, yeah, I think it is very much in that. I mean, I've read magical realism at this point. I've read, you know, certainly Kafka, like, dude wakes up as a beetle one day, right? And like, it's like, wait, what? And you're just off to the races. Like, you just accept it for what it is. And you know, in that way, there was a, I don't know, call it a curse for lack of a better term. And they were stuck in this, like, I don't know, parallel universe, if you want to call it that. And the kids saved them, and therefore they were released. I don't think there's a need for a deeper reading necessarily of that aspect of it. Again, was it too easy? Maybe, but it's a kid's book, so I'm okay with it.
Right. And I think this is where my adult-ness came over me, because I'm like, okay, so they weren't in India. They weren't imprisoned in India. They were still within that area for Lord knows how many years, at least 20 plus. And then they showed up. I was like, were they eating? Were they healthy? They show up and they seem like they pretty much physically unscathed. So it's not like they were in the torturous area. So my whole, I was more confused. Like, where did they come from? If they got released via the adventure part, where did they get released in the real world?
Somewhere by the house.
Yeah, or whatever. That's where I was getting confused.
I think, I mean, if I had to nitpick it, I was more like, how did Ned retain all this information that now he's off basically going to college and Harvard, no less? You know, yeah. Like, where did he attain this information? That would have been my nitpick. But again, I can forgive it. And then, you know, I mean, as far as predicting where the book would have ended up at, you know, okay, they need to get money to save the house. Okay, by the end, not a question in my mind, they're going to get the money.
Right.
One way or another. And then they
actually find Prince Krishna's treasures that was buried there under the noses all along. Did you expect it to be in the peacock feathers?
I did not. I wasn't. I was on the adventure. I know it's like a mystery adventure, but like, I was like, let me just go along for the ride, and I don't need to think too deeply about, you know, where it's like, I know where it's headed, and I'll just enjoy the ride.
It was kind of a red herring, which was actually done very smartly, because we, at the very, very beginning of the adventure, when they first like are on this mission to find, at this point, before they even had their first dream adventure, that like they're just trying to find hard treasure. And we get this whole scene where Eleanor is like dissecting the peacock. It's like, hey, it could be in the eyes. It could, she's like physically taking this apart, finds out it's empty, and then she puts it away. So it's already like training the reader, like, oh, it's not the peacock. But at the end of the day, it actually was. So I think it was very smart. It threw us off in that way. So I didn't see it coming.
But it's also one of those, like, not that this was exactly it, but like, you know, the real treasure was the friends you made along the way sort of thing. And so in this, mm-hmm. like, you know, their family become like, they couldn't find the treasure without the family being whole, you know?
Right.
So.
And it's also like with every adventure, and when they found each little thing, it was more so like the memories that came from the object. That's the thing that they had to take away and treasure more than the actual small items. And because, like, to a normal person, each little object could have been like nothing. Oh, and there was even a line, oh, this is a dime a dozen. Anyone could get this. It's not important. But the story behind each item, you know, really showed like what that family was like and how much love and friendship was there. And I enjoy that aspect of it.
Yeah.
Certainly. All right. So anything else about this book before we get a little bit into the author?
I thought it worked really well overall, and it had enough humorous moments, like you said, with Uncle Freddy and in particular Mr. Preak, whenever he showed up, like their confrontations together seemed to be, you know, in full effect. So I think it's a good page length and overall fun and easy read for kids. And obviously it sparked a bunch of other, you know, sequels, much in the way, you know, Wrinkle in Time did. We have not read those, or at least I have not read those. So I'm, you know, I can't say where it goes, but I think, you know, people get behind it and fall in love with the characters. And I think that's the most important thing when it comes to, you know, a series of books.
Absolutely. And I mean, this is the series. This is the first out of the series, and it's very standalone. They have their own characters, their own storylines, and it wraps up pretty nicely with the happy ending of marriage, and they live happily ever after. And then they have to go to India and figure out the political affairs over there, but they end up being together. And like, that's what I always enjoy, a nice romantic story. Call it the girl in me. I don't know. Like it ended up being happy, and you know, they ended up keeping the house. So, which is, you know, the whole that was the whole problem from the beginning. So it ended up nice and happy with the bow. So a little bit about Jane Langton. I have never read any of her books. I personally am not from the East Coast like you are. So I don't know if you were ever exposed to Jane Langton. I mean, definitely we had Emerson and Thoreau for sure. But
I mean, Concord, obviously, you know, very famous. And there was a lot of tie backs to, you know, Paul Revere and things of that nature. So very patriotic elements that certainly Massachusetts, and in particular Concord, is known for. And it's evident, you know, it's no different than Stephen King writing about Maine a lot of times, right? Even if he makes up a fictional town within Maine, you could tell like it's very near and dear to what he knows type of thing, right? And so so it's evident and it shows. Like, I think it's a strength of the book in that way. And given her history and her interests, it's, you know, it's there in terms of, yeah, I understand why she wrote about all these things.
Yeah. And so she actually went to school she wanted to be a scientist at a young age. But then she switched. All the scientists were away at war during World War II, including her boyfriend at the time. So like all the men were away, and then the teachers had to stay. And from there, she actually switched her major over to art. And so all the drawings in this book are actually her own pencil and ink illustrations, which I didn't know until after the fact and reading, reading the research. And I thought that was really cool because it's very well done. And I can only think of, I mean, a lot of authors have done that. From the top of my head, I can think of like Shel Silverstein and Dr. Seuss. They illustrate their own books, but she illustrated all of her books.
And she started, I mean, she wrote fairly late. You know what I mean? It's not like it was a passion.
In her career?
Yeah, I mean, she lived a couple of lives before that time. And I think it's evident, right? There's, you know, like we've talked about, there's a maturity there that I don't think a 30-year-old would have, you know, captured necessarily, you know, in that way. And so, she passed away not too long ago, I think 2018. Like, she was close to 100.
Like, yeah, she was definitely up there. You know. But good for her. She's seen a lot, and her husband died in 1997. She has two kids. So yeah, I thoroughly actually enjoyed this book. It's a fun adventure book. It makes you think a lot, especially I wish I would have read this as a teenager / kid, because this would definitely have been a book up my alley had I known about it. It's just amazing how many books slip under the radar. But I highly suggest it.
You're an aunt. Pass it down.
No, I will. I have two nieces who are at the prime age to actually read this. So I just might. I could be that cool Aunt Lily for them.
Absolutely.
So any last thoughts and remarks about this book?
No, I think, you know, it would be great to see this book sort of resurface, because I don't think a lot of people do know about it, and so forth. And I know her overall, she's gotten some awards for other books and things of that nature. But I don't know. I in a way, it doesn't seem like she's getting the credit that she perhaps deserves. And it's a shame.
It is a shame. And I mean, you have to think about it. This book was written in the 60s. So it's definitely not our, you and my generation. I had to read this via someone, or like I heard about this via someone who is older than I am. So I mean, it's not really exposed to our age.
Well, it's just also not really available. Like, right. It took me a while to get. It's not like LA is a pretty big place, and there's only like one copy in the public library that you can't take out. So, you know, that to me was sort of indicative of like, we got to circulate this a little bit more, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it just shows that there's so many good books out there if you look hard enough.
Yeah.
And I like to think this is one of them. So this is our due diligence telling you to go check this book out if you can. Read it and pass it along. It's a fun book for children, teenagers, and adults alike to read.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Phil, where can everyone follow you? And what is our next book that we're
going to be reading in 5 years?
There you go.
That is our next book. It is a Good Morning America book club pick. It is by Rebecca Searle, I believe is how you pronounce the name.
Yeah.
And so I've heard some good things. I didn't even read the summary, really. It seems very much just by the cover design and so forth, like a romance type of novel. So, yeah, it should be a fairly easy yet fun read. So I'm looking forward to it. And yeah. Phil Svitek, keeping it simple. Social media handles everywhere.
Awesome. And you can follow me at Serafini TV. Follow both Phil and I, just reading more and more books in the future. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Keep reading.